Welcome to This Is Money, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Lee Boyce. And coming up, it's been a busy week. Stricter benefit rules announced, bad government borrowing figures, strong wage growth, stagnant unemployment, interest rates held. Shake it all together, and what will we get next week in the spring statement? Simon and Lee take a punt. Also today, the deadline is fast approaching to use it or to lose it. ISA, baby. We explain the bed in ISA, a smart move to protect your investments from tax, and explore how to get a £5,000 tax-free income from a stocks and shares ISA. We have a millionaire reader question with a nice problem to have about inheritance tax, and I've been sent a parking ticket from a holiday in Italy a year ago. Do I still have to pay? Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, the Chancellor is under increasing pressure to raise taxes and cut spending to plug a £10 billion gap in the public finances or risk breaking her own borrowing rules. Next Wednesday is the spring statement, and government borrowing figures this week, really, well, they didn't look great, did they? But even if we don't get much in the way of tax rises next week, watch out for later in the year, warns experts. Right, firstly, it has been a big week for money, as I mentioned in the introduction. Wrap it up for us, if you would. The pressure mounting on the Chancellor ahead of next week's spring statement. Lee, do you want to take a run-up at this one?
So, yeah, we've got the spring statement coming on Wednesday, the 26th of March. Rachel Reeves is in a bit of a sticky spot, I would suggest. She's ruled out further tax rises after what we had delivered in the budget back last year. But she is facing some difficult choices because of the performance of the UK economy and things that are going on in the world. We can't deny that this is a difficult backdrop of what's going on. I always think that the spring statement is never quite as exciting as the budget. The budget is a bit more sort of like all singing, all dancing, lots of jostling around and lots of shouting in the chambers of politicians kind of going back and forth. The spring statement's more of a kind of update of where things are at, and you don't tend to get, you know, huge policy announcements at the spring statement. You get some things in the run-up to it, which is kind of where we are at. So earlier in the week, the Treasury revealed plans for major changes to the benefit system, which aims to generate savings of £5 billion a year. That's in response to the growing welfare bill. That includes stricter tests for PIP, so personal independence payments, which will affect hundreds of thousands of claimants, and a freeze on incapacity benefits in cash terms at £97 a week until 2029-30. That's not been an incredibly popular move, I would say, within the Labour Party. It's sort of quite an anti-Labour move, you could argue. Going back to what's happening kind of around the world, and we sort of tamed the inflation beast, but the worries are that the inflation beast might get untamed again. We'll talk about interest rates a little bit later in the show. But, you know, that's another thing, another kind of headache for the Chancellor, I would argue. We'll have Office for Budget Responsibility forecasts on the UK economy. The rumours are that that's not going to be very happy reading for the Chancellor. Again, put more pressure on what can she do? After all of the tax rises that were announced in the budget, it's kind of hard to start reading even more, I would suggest. And one of the big things, again, I'm sure we're going to talk about a little bit later in the show, fiscal drag in terms of things like income tax. You know, it's becoming a very hot topic amongst workers, amongst Britons. And I think if you mix all that up in a big pot, Georgie, you know, I go back to being the Chancellor is a thankless job. And I sometimes have that vision of what would I do if I was Chancellor? Maybe it'd be quite good fun. Like, you know, you get to make these policy decisions. And then I think, is it the biggest headache inducing job in the country, is it more of a challenge than actually being prime minister? I sometimes think that quite possibly it is. You're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. But a lot of what Rachel Reeves and Labour have inherited, you know, you could argue that something like the fiscal drag and the freezing in the income tax bans, for example, you know, the scene was set by Rishi Sunak in 2021 when he announced the freeze. It's just how much extra we keep putting this freeze on in terms of tax bans, for example. We've been told to the back teeth about the financial black hole. We don't know what size the financial black hole truly is, but there's going to be lots of difficult decisions that are going to be made. And I think it's going to upset quite a lot of the Labour Party and its voters. Let's face it, I think that it's going to be quite possibly not popular what they're about to do. What wasn't popular, I would say, in the budget last year was for the typical kind of Conservative Party voter, probably quite upset with quite a lot of the moves. I think this time around, in the spring statement, with the kind of nudging around of benefits and all that kind of stuff, it's not really pleasing, you know, what you would say a typical Labour supporter.
It's weird, isn't it, Lee? Well, you had a Conservative Party that raised taxes to the hilt and felt like the most Labour, and now you've got a Labour Party that's going after benefits, and it feels quite conservative.
Do you know what? Honestly, I had pretty much that exact same thought in the shower this morning. You know, when you do your big thinking, I was thinking we're doing this podcast. That was honestly my train of thought, and I kind of it's quite mad, isn't it?
Isn't it just, Simon? We're talking about this 10 billion fiscal black hole, these fiscal rules that the Chancellor has set herself. Can she not sort of take a bit of a more holistic view of the situation and say, look, maybe we need to just tweak them a little bit. We've not even been in power a year. I've got to undo a lot of what the Conservatives, that's what they would argue, have done. You know, maybe let's bring in these fiscal rules in a couple of years when we're a bit more settled. What are the fiscal rules, firstly?
Right. Before I tell you the fiscal rules, I think underpinning the fiscal rule problem is something that Lee referred to there. And the first mistake that was made was the bit where Rachel Reeves, Keir Starmer, and the rest of the gang went around for a few months shouting about £22 billion black holes. Up until the point when the £22 billion black hole became a kind of almost parodyable phrase, nobody was particularly concerned about the UK's public finances. In fact, there was quite a lot of optimism when the Labour Party came into power. Change of government, probably more competent than the last lot. Reasonably low bar there. I mean, Keir Starmer sold them on competency, could come in and could actually make a difference, that they were going to go for growth. And maybe, just maybe, we were going to see some of those things that have been a problem unpicked. For example, frozen tax thresholds and so on. Unfortunately, what we got was the Labour government deciding to dampen out the optimism itself.
Miserabilism, Simon.
Miserabilism, yeah. We got miserabilism. We got 100 days of miserabilism. So then we went into the budget expecting every tax in the world to rise. Unfortunately, in the manifesto, they promised that they weren't going to put up taxes on working people. So they put up national insurance on employers, which is different to national insurance on employees, although arguably is still a tax on working people. But we're not going to get into that because that's been done to death. However, what this did was it enabled Rachel Reeves, to go back to your fiscal rule question, to update her fiscal rule, which is basically a variation on Jeremy Hunt's fiscal rule theme. And what it is that twofold, funding day-to-day government spending with tax revenues in 5 years. Also, cutting debt as a share of GDP between the fourth and fifth years of the OBR forecast. After the budget and everything that happened in it, which involved tax rises, it also involved some spending rises as well in some places, Rachel Reeves was judged to have left herself £9.9 billion worth of headroom. This is the margin of error for hitting those numbers. And that's all based on what the OBR forecast was going to happened to the economy in terms of growth, in terms of tax revenue, in terms of spending, and also in terms of, importantly, servicing the debts that we already have and the debts that we incur. Unfortunately, with the spring statement brings a revision of those OBR forecasts. I believe that Rachel Reeves may already have those in the bag. She's got them. She knows what's going to happen. I hope they don't give them to her like just before the spring statement and she has to like quickly go, you can't see that, can you? But yeah, I'm pretending to write on the back of something. They will be revealed to us all next week. The widespread expectation is of two things. One, that the growth forecast is going to be cut. And I read a suggestion this morning that it might be cut from a forecast of 2% this year to 1% this year, which is not good. Mm-hmm. And secondly, that the OBR is going to talk about how borrowing costs have gone up. Now, the ultimate result of this is that Rachel Reeves's headroom is judged to be completely gone. And in fact, not only is her headroom gone, but she's back in a position where she needs to raise more money. So she's got a couple of choices on how she does that, to go back to your question. She could change her rules. Now, these rules are not hard and fast economic rules. These are just rules that somebody made up. In this instance, Rachel Reeves, but before that, it was Jeremy Hunt. And you could argue that by creating these rules and then sticking to them too closely and making them too prescriptive, that we're actually shooting ourselves in the foot. Chancellors have found themselves between a rock and a hard place for some time now due to the huge amount of debt that we have, large amount of spending, the aging population, and also a number of major crises. So we had the financial crisis, and then obviously, just as we looked like we'd finally managed to claw our way back from that one, we had COVID. Now, arguably, the big mistake with COVID, among the many big mistakes with COVID, was that we tried to start clawing that money back too quickly. Rishi Sunak did that, okay? We had an unprecedented global pandemic where we were all told to stay in our homes, businesses were shut, schools were shut, all this kind of stuff. And then we started trying to get them all the money back that we'd spent to try and support the economy really, really soon after, before actually the effects have completely followed through. So if we hadn't have done that, then maybe things would have been a bit better, but we did do that. She could change the rules, but it doesn't look good if you change your own rules less than 6 months after you brought them in. Okay, that's not going to make her look good. Markets aren't going to like that. People aren't going to like that. Nobody's going to look like that. She's going to get heavily criticized for it. So that leaves her with two choices. Does she raise more money in tax? But she's already said she's not going to do that. And she already did actually bring in quite a lot of tax rises in the budget. So she probably doesn't want to come back for more tax already. And also the other thing she's committed to doing is making this a actual spring statement. So not like the kind of dual budget thing that chancellors always slip into. And again, you don't want to break that with your first one, right? Maybe leave it a year before you break that one. So she could put taxes up, doesn't want to do that. Or we could have less spending. And this is what we expect is going to happen, that we're going to see spending cuts. Major, major spending cuts.
Does that mean austerity mark two? Is that what we're talking about here? Austerity mark two?
That is what it is being labelled as in some corners by people who either very much were opposed to the spending cuts that were termed austerity, or potentially also people within the political party that brought in austerity because they've seen a political opportunity here to have a crack at Rachel Reeves and the Labour Party. I mean, we've got a story today suggesting that she'll tell Whitehall departments to tighten their belts by as much as 11% and that they're going to be seizing control and access to the spreadsheets used by other departments to improve spending control. This does not sound like a happy ship. And you've got health, education and defence budgets that are protected, which means that other departments are going to see massive cuts. And this is at a time when most of our public services are not doing very well at all and actually need a lot more money. So, you know, take things like the Ministry of Justice. We've got this huge courts backlog. We've got prison overcrowding. We've got the Home Office, which is struggling. All of these things are potentially going to see their budgets cut. And the other bad news bears moment here is that also ONS figures to February this year show that in terms of tax, we are actually getting more money in. So tax in that year to February was up 34.3 billion to 941 billion. Unfortunately, on the other side of the equation, spending was also up by 41.7 billion to over a trillion. And government borrowing in the financial year to date is up £15 billion in a year. So it's not a pretty picture, and it's a very, very difficult situation that Rachel Reeves finds herself in.
I want to talk to you about the ONS in a minute, but Lee, do they need this money right now? Can they wait? Will we default? I mean, what will be the implications if we just pause a little bit, maybe try and get, you know, some of the more growthy things that the Labour Party want to bring in going a bit.
Yeah, I know what you mean, Georgie. You think that you come in fresh government, fresh perspective, and you think, you know, go for growth, let's do it. It's obviously given enough of a worry that they feel that they need to be going down this route. You say 11% feels quite chunky, and you're right, it does feel quite chunky, but they must feel that there are measures that can be undertaken in some of these departments in a bonfire of the quangos. Can they start picking through spreadsheets, you know, think about a spreadsheet Phil. I mean, we've got a spreadsheet Rachel here looking like she's going to go through and find out where, you know.
It sounds very doge-ish, doesn't it? They've got their own Elon Musk going through all these sort of departments going, you can go, you can go.
Yeah, and that's the thing, isn't it? It's like you could argue that some of these departments potentially are a bit bloated. And I should point out here that some of these cuts of certain departments are kind of off limits. So I think the ones that are off limits, health, education, defence budgets are protected. But some of them that face being hit, Ministry of Justice, and that's despite courts backlog and prison overcrowding and the Home Office. That sounds quite worrying, doesn't it? Because they're not two departments that strike me as they're doing very well, they're efficient and working the best they can. But I also think that sometimes you have to shine a spotlight on some of this. And so they obviously feel confident that there's ways to cut parts of this without it being damaging, but it's really hard to see. You're right, you know, we're still less than a year into this government, and it's all a bit doom and gloom in that respect, isn't it? Rather than that kind of going for growth mantra, it feels like it is austerity part two. Yeah, you know, it's hard to argue that it isn't.
Quite one department that's not gonna be cut, Simon, is defence.
No, we're going to spend more money on defence because we need to spend more money on defence because of the increasing threat from Russia, other countries, and America's decision to step back from the role that it has occupied for decades and to leave Europe a bit more to fend for itself, you know, threats of pulling itself out of NATO. And I mean, you know, it is possible for people to be both right and wrong. And Donald Trump is often really quite wrong in my book. And I don't like the way that he goes about things. I think, you know, obviously he thinks the way that he's going about things is very clever. I am in the camp that thinks the way he's going about things is not very clever at all. However, he does have a point about his European peers not spending enough on defence. And so we are going to ramp up defence spending. I mean, this has been fantastic news for those people who hold shares in defence companies. BAE shares, you know, have done very, very well. Rolls-Royce shares, which isn't like a defence company in itself, but benefits from it have done very, very well. But so we're going to need to find more money for that. And that is unfortunately a scenario where, say, you wind the clock back a year, we weren't probably expecting to have to find as much money for defence back then as we are expected to now. And that pressure is only going to mount. I think the fundamental issue here, though, is something that both you and Lee have mentioned. It's the growth issue. The problem is that we just keep making the same mistake again and again and again. What we need is for the economy to be growing. Now, in that situation, Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer both say that. And in fact, they're in agreement with that other famous big fan of growth, Liz Truss, and her Chancellor Kwasi Kwarteng. But they've both decided to go about it in different ways. Now, Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng came from a world of kind of, you know, right-wing think tankery where basically if you cut taxes, you will get growth. And they went on a, you know, tax-slashing bonanza without bothering to get the OBR involved, and it all backfired very badly. But they had a point. You know, the underlying thing was that they had a point. We needed to get growth going. And arguably, you know, you could say that after many, many years of putting the squeeze on people on tax and everything, that perhaps that wasn't working. We needed to try a different tactic. Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer, you know, they also have a point. They come from a world of left-wing think tankery and wonkishness, where every problem can be unpicked by, like, you know, dealing with some policies and doing this and doing that. You know, like if you look at, for example, the stuff around planning and everything like that and getting stuff built and everything, there's this whole like chunk of people who are like really, really interested in this, like absolute brainiacs. And they're like, if we change this and we change the way we do things, we change the way we do that, that's how we get the growth. The problem is a lot of that growth isn't going to come for a long time. You know, you can promise to build 1.5 million homes a year, but even if you went absolutely hell for leather tearing up the planning system, you're still going to take your time to get the growth off the back of that. What they needed was something that was going to deliver growth straight away. And that's where you go back to the Liz Truss Kwasi Kwarteng thing, where actually, arguably, you know, cutting people's taxes, especially people with money, which they did and got absolutely walloped for. Although, to be fair, they did also cut the basic rate of tax for everyone, but managed to overshadow it by stupidly cutting tax for rich people at exactly the same time. They're putting more money in people's pockets, you know, that can actually deliver short-term growth. So what we need is like something in the middle of the two, I think. Or maybe the four of them to all get together and like have a real melting pot of ideas. Government of many talents. Rachel Reeves, Keir Starmer, Liz Truss, Kwasi Kwarteng. They're back. Like the Expendables.
I mean, yeah, many talents. Some might question the billing. Lee, interest rates held. What does it mean for our money? Let's get sensible again.
Yes, we had an interest rate decision this week. It was a very nailed on hold. 8 MPC members voted to hold rates. 1 voted for a cut. As I say, it's been priced in for a while. There wasn't really any expectations of a cut this time round. And actually, Bank of England Chief Andrew Bailey has warned that Britain faces a lot of economic uncertainty and pointed to turmoil sparked by the trade tariffs, subdued activity in the UK, where businesses have been hammered by Labour's tax hikes. He kind of hinted that we're on a gradually declining path and there's 2 more cuts expected this year, but it all feels like it's up in the air again. We have seen, in terms of your finances, mortgage rates have been inching slightly lower, but there's not really been a huge direct impact from what happened yesterday, because a lot of what happens in the mortgage market is already priced in. We did have Nationwide cut a few rates. We are seeing some rates still below 4%, but they are only for those who have high LTV. So those who have big deposits, you know, you can just about get under 4%. But before you go and leap in on one of those headline rates, I would urge you to check the fees and do an overall comparison, because there's a lot of tomfoolery happening, I would suggest, both in the mortgage world and the savings world. And in terms of savings rates have been sort of nudging a little bit lower, but there's still this battle in the easy access cash ISA stakes. We're going to talk ISAs in a minute. It's not having a huge at the moment. It's quite stable. I would argue that it's quite stable, and that because it was so nailed on, not a huge amount of movement has happened. And the next decision is on the 8th of May. So we've got a little bit of breathing space, it feels, between now and the 8th of May. We're obviously going to have the spring statement in between. Who knows what could happen in the next 5 weeks, Georgie, 6 weeks. More trade tariffs, more geopolitical turmoil. It's a hard one to predict. But I think the one thing we could have predicted this week that were rates were going to be held. And I think 8 out of 9 members is, you know, pretty much as strong as it gets on the whole. But yeah, what moves happen next? And if rates are going to start coming down, those 2 cuts would take us potentially down to 4%. If they were both, you know, 2.25% cuts, that's kind of vaguely what we were talking about probably 6 months ago. So watch this space.
Indeed, Lee, watch this space. We will talk about ISAs very shortly, but I did just want to cover very quickly, Simon, because you mentioned the ONS there, and I've been reading, you know, articles and criticisms about figures coming from the ONS, particularly around pensions and also the employment figures we got this week, saying it's from kind of a small set. And, you know, I don't really like a lot of these figures oftentimes, particularly house prices, just because I think there are so many of them. They don't really mean that much. I'm sure they're very useful in some quarters. But considering so many major decisions are made on, you know, expectations, which are inevitably changed at a later date, what's going on here?
Well, I mean, firstly, the ONS puts out an incredible amount of information. It does have an incredible amount of information. For example, put out some great figures the other week about incomes, like, you know what, and you can look at like where people are on the percentage of the income scale and stuff like that. But putting out all of this information requires gathering a huge amount of information. And some of that is done in different ways. And a lot of it used to be done in a kind of survey way. you know, by asking people questions. It has become apparently harder to get people to do those and to fill them in. You've got obviously that if you reduce your sample size, then it causes you problems. So trying to get more of this information digitally, but getting yourself set up to do that, you know, takes time, costs money, involves quite a lot of work. Once you get it set up and you start getting really good data, then that's great. And sometimes things crop up where they illustrate that actually there's a problem with the underlying way that the report or the data works. So for example, if you look at the wages figures going back to the post-COVID recovery, we saw really, really high, artificially high wages when people started coming back into work off furlough and things like that. Now, arguably, that should have been a problem that you could have spotted ahead of time and then you'd ironed it out from the statistics. But instead, we just got the statistics delivered to us and it led to a much bigger rise in the triple lock than, you know, was expected. That was the year that there was the big argument about the triple lock. The triple lock ended up being, you know, broken somewhat. So it can cause like quite big knock-on problems. And yeah, as you say, you know, the Bank of England are basing decisions on this, the government's basing decisions on this, businesses base decisions on this. Is it something where, you know, the advance in technology and AI and things like that is going to make a big difference? I don't know. I don't know enough about it. I do know from my limited experience of using AI that you have to be very, very careful about the result that it gives you. You need a competent human being in charge of it, checking up on that stuff. But it can dramatically reduce the amount of time it takes to do certain things. For example, I had to look up the performance of 5 investment funds over 1 year and 5 years, and I had to do that manually. It took me about half an hour to do it. And then I suddenly thought at the end of it, that's the kind of thing I should have asked AI to do for me. So I just pasted it into Copilot, which is the one I used, and it gave me the answers. And I was like, oh, could have saved myself half an hour there. But what I did have to do is I did have to go and check all of those figures independently myself, follow the links and check the figures. Because if I'd have just used those figures, chances are that like AI might have got it wrong. Because it does regularly, as we know from those results at the top of Google.
That's it for part one.
I am joined now by Alex Webbone of Charles Stanley Direct for our weekly Investing Explained feature. Alex, welcome to the podcast. Here's a quick question from someone. I am 32 and my partner and I are saving for our first home. Should we get a lifetime ISA?
Hi, Simon. So a quick answer is it depends. So lifetime ISAs are designed to help people get on the property ladder, and there are obvious benefits as a result. So the main one being the government will add a 25% bonus to whatever you manage to save that year, up to a maximum of £1,000. So if you put in £4,000 into your ISA, the government will contribute the full £1,000 on top. This money also grows in a tax-free environment, and you can also have individual ISAs to put towards the same property, assuming you're both first-time buyers. So that's all the good stuff. There are some other aspects to consider, though. For example, if you were to withdraw money for any reason other than buying your first home, reaching age 60 or being terminally ill, you'll have to pay a 25% charge. Now, that's on the total value, including any interest or investment growth, so it's more than simply repaying the government bonus. You'll also need to buy a property that costs £450,000 or less and with a residential mortgage, so not a buy-to-let, or you can't be a full cash buyer. The government website is really good for all the details, lists all the terms and conditions, and financial experts like us at Charles Stanley are available for a free call to talk you through it if you'd like.
Alex, that's great. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Simon.
Welcome back. Use it or lose it. You have a couple of weeks to fill up as much of your ISA allowance this tax year before the clock strikes midnight and you lose it. Lee Boyce, explain the rules.
Yeah, so you've got until the end of this tax year, 5th of April, to use up your £20,000 annual allowance. You can blend that over a savings version, a stocks and shares version, one or the other. You can mix it all up, whatever you want to do. And you're looking to sort of do this before the deadline. I wouldn't leave it right up to the last minute, because especially depending on the size of the provider, you could be left disappointed if you do it too last minute. Trust me, a lot of people do, way more than what you think. Now, ISAs have really been in the spotlight this year. We had the rumours over the potential cut in the cash ISA element. That doesn't look like it's going to happen. I would have been very surprised if it was going to happen for the next tax year, because it would have been fiendishly complicated to kind of just all of a sudden drop that limit. It would have caused all sorts of headaches, I would imagine, with providers. So that, for now, looks safe, but that does not suggest that it isn't safe in the future. You might question yourself as to what the point of an ISA is. The point of an ISA is you are shielding as much of your savings as you can from the tax man. Now, you might be someone that doesn't have a huge savings pot, or, you know, you might be relatively young and you've just started out work and you've not even really started the savings habit, for example, and you're saying, what's the point of this? But it's the kind of product where future you will thank you for building up a pot from away from the clutches of the tax man, because if you work your way up the career ladder as a basic rate taxpayer, you can earn £1,000 of interest before you trigger tax. As a higher rate taxpayer, that limit is £500 interest. As an additional rate taxpayer, is zero. Your personal savings allowance is zero. So it's more crucial as you go up those bands. More of us have been sucked into those higher tax bands, and it makes perfect sense to utilize a cash ISA. Even if your interest payments aren't going to go over that, there is the possibility that in future years it will, and it would have been well worth having it put into an ISA. I also think ISAs have become much easier in the past year. I know Simon's a big fan of the flexible ISA, where you can dip in and out. Because I think a lot of the time people think, it's an ISA, it's kind of locked away, I can't really go and take the money out if I need it in an emergency. But a lot of the providers now do offer a flexible way of doing it. And one last thing I want to say about cash ISAs, and I know Simon will take over on the investing side of things, but do be a little bit careful. There is a bit of a savings battle at the moment at the top of the cash ISA tables. It's been driven by lots of smaller providers and platforms and things like that. And they've gone down to this thing about offering really short-term bonuses, so a three-month bonus that pumps up the rate. And then they're kind of, it's hard to decipher, but if you are being offered a 5% rate for 3 months and then that drops to 3.5% for the next 9 months of that year, you ain't getting 5% over the course of the year. So be careful whereabouts you're opening up an account. But my biggest thing is just to use it. And if you are listening to this and you think you might benefit from moving some of your easy access cash or cash you might have in your current account because it's at hand, have a look what your bank is offering. You know, I'm not saying that banks are offering anything great, but there are a few offering fairly decent rates, and getting a fairly decent rate is better than not getting a good rate at all. And that, we had some research out this week, actually, Georgia, there's something like 30, 40 billion pounds in cash ISAs that is earning under 2%. I mean, that is crazy. That's just instant access cash that's been kind of languishing somewhere people have forgotten about. If you've got old pots knocking around, floating around, just go and move it. Make that money work harder. Well worth utilising the ISA. You know I'm a big fan of ISAs. It's such an important financial tool. I would say that saving in your private pension is probably number one. Then building up a pot into an ISA is probably, for me, number two in terms of what you can do, you know, to give yourself a financially secure future.
Simon, Lee said there you'll delve into the stocks and shares ISA. Actually, you and Rosie have been looking at just this subject, how to get a £5,000 tax-free income from a stocks and shares ISA. Just explain this.
Okay, so I should caveat this with the fact that in order to get your £5,000 a year tax-free income from a stocks and shares ISA, you are going to need a £100,000 ISA pot. That's obviously quite a big hurdle to clear, particularly as you can only put £20,000 a year in. And most people couldn't come anywhere close to putting £20,000 a year in. If you were starting from scratch, then you need 5 years to get there. And for most people, you'd need an awful lot longer. However, what I would say is that this shows the importance of long-term investing. and, you know, starting early, regular investing, building up that pot, because you could one day be able to have your £5,000 a year tax-free income from your stocks and shares ISA. And this is how it works. If you hit that £100,000 amount, then you could invest in income delivering investments. For example, investment trusts would be my recommendation, particularly those focused on income, because they have the ability to hold back some dividends in the good years to keep paying out dividends in the bad years. And some of them are what is known as dividend heroes, which we had an update on that list from the Association of Investment Companies this week. And the City of London Investment Trust has had 58 years in a row of raising dividend payouts without a single break. That is amazing. And the dividend yield on City of London Investment Trust is 4.72%. So you're not quite going to get £5,000 off your 100 grand, but you're going to be near as damn it. JP Morgan Claver House, 52 years in a row. Murray Income Trust, 51 years in a row. And you know, this is an astonishing record for some of these things. You could invest in an investment fund as well. You could invest in an ETF. You could hold a portfolio of shares. But holding something like that gives you the ability to get those dividends. But you should also consider other investments as well. For example, you probably want to have a blend of investments. You might want to hold some bonds. You could hold individual bonds. I mean, you could buy some government bonds at the moment, UK government bonds that are going to pay you fairly close to 5%. Or even 5%, but you might want to go for a bond fund where somebody else does the difficult bit of managing it for you. And you might want to hold some cash as well, because you can get cash ISA that pays you 5%, as Lee just mentioned. So you can get a blend of stuff in your ISA that pays you that tax-free income. But what you really want to know is, how am I going to get to 100 grand, isn't it? How long is it going to take me? Well, if you could invest your full ISA allowance of £20,000 a year, it would take you 5 years, working on the basis that your previous contributions didn't go down in value, and you'd get there even quicker if you actually got some investment growth as well. But for those people who can't invest £20,000 a year, i.e. me, probably both of you, probably most people listening to this, if you could invest £400 a month, and you got an average annual return of 5% after charges, it would take just under 15 years to get there. If you could up that to £500 a month, it would take just over 12 years. If you could up it to £1,000 a month, which is a lot, right? You could reduce the time frame to 7 years. And if you could invest only £200 a month, it would take you just under 23 years. Now, that's a long time. But if you stick to that plan, it could make a major difference to some of the ambitions that you might hold for yourself in 20 odd years' time, such as potentially early retirement, working on your own terms, greater financial independence and stuff like that. So if you're one of those people who doesn't have a stocks and shares ISA and would like to invest in a stocks and shares ISA, here's how to get started. People often think about investing as something that is complicated. Fortunately, due to the advent of online investing platforms and investing apps, it's actually incredibly easy. What you need to do is you need to find yourself an investment platform. And in order to do that, you need to decide how engaged you want to be. Do I want to be the kind of person who picks my own shares, funds, investment trusts, exchange traded funds myself? So I'm going to choose what I think is best. Or do I want a service that's going to do that for me? There's a mix of services that you can get out there. There are some that are more dedicated towards people picking their own investments. There are some that are more dedicated towards you answer some questions and they'll choose a selection of investments for you. They're often called digital wealth managers. To look at the first ones, you know, first of all, where you pick your own investments, you've got the established players, the Hargreaves Lansdowns, Interactive Investors, Charles Stanley Direct, sponsors of this podcast, AJ Bells of this world, and they'll offer you the full range of investments, investment funds, shares, investment trusts, exchange traded funds. You then got some of the newer breed of online app providers such as Trading212, Free Trade, Invest Engine, and they will offer you maybe a more restricted selection of investments. Often they don't offer investment funds. The main difference between investment funds and investment trusts is investment trusts are listed on the stock market themselves, and exchange-traded funds as well, which are also listed on the stock market. And they just tend to follow an index where an investment fund or an investment trust will have a manager trying to pick investments that they think will outperform. There's nothing wrong with that, but you've got to realize that by doing that, you open yourself up to the possibility that they'll get it wrong and they will actually underperform. And there's a lot of statistics showing that most fund managers do not manage to beat the market. You could obviously go pick your own shares yourself, but then you need to have a diversified portfolio of companies that do different things, probably at least about 20 of them, not just chase the thing that's gone up the most, because then you might find yourself holding something that has then gone down the most. Read up on Tesla shares if you want to learn more about that. Or you go for something like one of these services that does it for you, a Wealthify, a Money Farm, a Nutmeg. You go there, you answer some questions, and it picks your investments for you. Those are more expensive. The absolute cheapest way is to choose one of the apps like Trading 212 or InvestEngine, or there's another app called Prosper as well. They that have no account fees, no dealing charges. Or you can go for the more tried and tested thing, the Charles Stanley's, Hargreaves Lansdown's, Interactive Investors. And a lot of these places will also have model portfolios. So that's stuff picked by experts who basically have chosen things that might be right for a person like you. Or you can just choose a really simple, cheap tracker fund or ETF that follows the global stock market. And then you can invest at a very, very low cost and you're backing all of the companies in the world, all of the markets in the world, all of the companies within those markets. And you're relying on their ability to take money, put it to productive use and get profit from it to boost your investments over the long term. But the most important thing is that you actually do something about it. So go to thisismoney.co.uk/platforms to learn more about those investment platforms that we were just talking about. And if you go to thisismoney.co.uk/ISA investing, you can find all our articles about ISA investing and just get started. And as Lee said, don't leave it to the last minute, because invariably you end up having to do something like move money from one account to another account or things like that. And that's where you get caught out.
I want to know what a better ISA is, Simon. Just ever so briefly before we move on to pensions.
Oh, it sounds massively geeky, doesn't it? I'm doing a bed and ISA. Yeah, I've done a couple of bed and ISAs in my time.
It sort of sounds like a Netflix and chill of finance.
Ooh,
do you know what I mean?
That's a horrible thought, isn't it?
how to make ISAs sexy? Yeah,
a bed and ISA is for people who haven't got a Netflix and chill on the cards that evening.
Yeah.
Oh, I'll do my ISA instead. Yeah. Right, so this is actually a way of using up as much of your ISA allowance as possible, and this is a pretty nifty trick. I usually hate the words nifty trick, but it's actually a nifty trick. So listen up. Have you got any investments outside of an ISA? If you have, and you're listening to this, you should seriously consider selling them and then buying them back within an ISA. You will trigger a capital gain. So you need to be careful if you've made big profits on them, because you'll have to pay capital gains tax. But you have a £3,000 capital gains tax free allowance every year. And if you've got investments outside of an ISA, use that £3,000 each year and then try to get those investments into an ISA, because in future, those investments will be protected from tax. You won't have to pay any tax on your profits, capital gain, and you won't have to pay any tax on your dividends. Both of those have become a lot more swinging in recent years. So it really, really does pay to do this. And there are lots of people who might have like old shareholdings that they have, maybe an old investment fund holding, or maybe you're one of those people who's in a share scheme through work. And with share schemes through work, you buy the shares, or maybe you get given some shares. And often, although you can put those into an ISA straight away, people don't do that bit. And so they end up with a pot of shares that are outside of an ISA. Or maybe you got bought some shares when you were younger, by your parents or your grandparents or things like that. If you can, look into selling those, buying them back within an ISA, helps you use up some of your ISA allowance. It's totally okay. You're allowed to buy back the same investments, but outside of an ISA, you aren't allowed to sell the same investments to realize capital gains and buy them back within 30 days. But if you do it and buy them in an ISA, you are allowed to do it. And there's also a thing for people who are really into the fruity stuff called a bed and sip, where you sell it and buy it back within a pension.
Thank you, Simon. Sticking with the changing of the tax year, we also have a pensions annual allowance we can use. It's not quite as strict as the use it or lose it ISA you can actually bring forward. I think it's 3 years if you haven't used it. But just explain the pension allowance, why it might be beneficial to top up your pension before the end of the tax year.
Yes, most people, apart from the very highest earners, can pay up to £60,000 a year into their pension. What you need to realise is that that's not £60,000 plus the tax relief that you get from the government on top of it, plus your employer's contributions. It's £60,000, including all those things. It also is a £60,000 or the maximum amount that you earn that year. So, for example, you're not allowed to earn £20,000 and put £60,000 into your pension. Again, this isn't going to be a problem for a lot of people because there aren't many people who could put £60,000 into a pension, even allowing for the government tax relief and the employer top up. But it can pay off to do this. You can roll this allowance over, but it can really pay off to do this for those people who are close to a tax threshold. So if you're about to go into, for example, the 40% tax threshold, it might pay to do this. Does rely on you having the money to do it, okay, just to be clear. But the place where it really pays off is for people who are about to get hit by marginal rates of tax due to the traps in the system. If you are at the point where you might go over 100 grand or you're just over 100 grand, you will have your personal allowance removed from you at a rate of £1 for every extra £2 you earn. This means that you pay an effective marginal tax rate of 60%. So on the next pound you earn, you lose 60% of its tax. This is a really rubbish bit of the tax system. If you pay some money into your pension, it reduces your income. You don't get caught by that. Child benefit as well. This catches many more people because it is lower down the scale. Once you go over a certain point, you start to have your child benefit taken off you. If you pay some money into your pension, you can reduce your income and you can deal with that. If you get tax-free childcare and you're about to go over £100,000, this is one of the completely maddest things in the system ever, because you lose all of your tax-free childcare at your 30 hours down to 15 hours, I think, and you lose all of your entitlement to the tax-free childcare system. So it can really pay off to put some money into a pension there. So if you're one of these people, then it's seriously worth considering. And also, money that goes into your pension is money that can grow for your retirement in future. Just be aware that you are not going to be able to get that money until you are age 57.
Mm-hmm. Quite. All right, then. Reader question time, Lee. I started a modest software company 27 years ago. Alas, this is definitely not me. It's become fairly successful. Understatement. My wife and I have benefited accordingly, and our combined earnings and annual dividends amount to 6 to 8 million quid. Lee, this is a long question. I know you don't like long questions. Basically, look, they've got all their savings and investments that you'd expect. They've helped their kids get on the property ladder. They've got a 2 million trust for them, etc. In the next couple of years, he'd like to retire and sell up. So he wants to know how we can gift a fair amount. I think it's a million of that, sort of 6 to 8 million, but doesn't want to fall foul of HMRC. What's the answer, Lee?
Can I just say on this one, I mean, absolutely brilliant. And fair play to the reader that's got in touch with us here. You know, I absolutely love hearing success stories and things where, you know, have taken off. Probably couldn't have expected it to have given them the lifestyle that he's got. I was quite frustrated when I looked in the reader comments of this story and lots of people thought we've made this up. But the question is so specific. There's absolutely no way we could make this question up. I'll tell you why, and I know why. It's because people are saying, why would you write in when you've got all of this money? You would have a financial advisor. And I'm sure he has, but sometimes you kind of want to hear from other people. And we do have the power to speak to lots of different financial advisors and experts all in one fell swoop. And, you know, we have a very successful financial planning section of the website in which people will come and read these stories, and they want to get some of that slice of pie and see if there's something that they're missing, you know, in terms of their own finances. So the long and short of this one, really, George, is we know about the 7-year rule. You know, if you give money and you pass away, you're on the hook for, you know, the beneficiary is on the hook for IHT. But and we've mentioned this on the podcast a couple of times, is the gifting out of surplus income is the key to this, because they're drawing an income from this money. So as Peter Hargreaves from Financial Planner EQ Investors replies here, to qualify for the exemption, the gifts must form part of a regular expenditure pattern, so i.e. be consistent and ongoing, yeah, be made out of income rather than capital, and leave you with sufficient income to maintain your usual standard of living. I think they're going to be ticking the three boxes out of it there. And it's just about, again, I know I sound like a broken record sometimes, but it is about keeping a very robust record of what you're doing, because it just it makes it easier. It makes it easier to prove things in the future. You know, this person also that's written, that's got time on their side. You know, he's 66, his wife is 57. And you might say, why are you worrying about all this? Why are you worrying about IHT? You've made more money than you can possibly ever think of. You know, really, you know, not in like tens and hundreds of millions of pounds, but you know what I mean? Like, this is a very, very comfortable person. But if you've built something from scratch and you've contributed to the tax system by potentially having employees and that kind of thing, you've contributed quite fairly to the system. You have built this business from scratch. I think a lot of people kind of worry about how much of it's then going to get taxed again down the line for the beneficiaries. Now, you might argue and say, well, that's just a problem. That's just like rich people problems. But it is also a kind of a wealth and a kind of an aspirational problem, isn't it? Where it's like, oh, I'm going to set up a business and what, you're just going to tax me to the hill and it's all going to be gone in like 20, 30, 40 years. It's not a great thought, but it requires lots of financial planning. So, and I'm sure this person that's written in must have themselves a good financial advisor.
Right, finally, I have not been sent 2 parking tickets for €98, £82 from Italy. Where were you a year ago, Simon? Your reader goes on to say, I was on holiday there more than a year ago and they've just only been issued to me. Do I have to pay? This is a question for consumer lawyer Dean Dunham.
Okay, the best thing about Dean Dunham's column, right, is that Dean Dunham answers the questions. And as you just pointed out, Dean Dunham is actually a consumer rights lawyer. So Dean Dunham actually knows the answer to this, which is an improvement on what you would normally do is ask your mate or Google it, right? And it might come up with a number of different answers. So the definitive answer on this is you got 2 parking tickets from Italy. You were on holiday there more than a year ago, and they've only just been issued. Do you have to pay? Dean says, the Italian Highway Code, or Codice della Strada, is the cornerstone of... Did you like that? I thought I did quite well there. Is the cornerstone of... Please don't write in if you're Italian and tell me I did terribly. Codice della Strada is the cornerstone of road safety and traffic regulation in Italy. It covers everything from speed limits to traffic signals and parking regulations. Article 260 of the code deals with offences committed by foreign nationals and states that a notice of violation of the traffic code must be sent to the foreigner within 360 days of discovery of the violation. However, the notification time may be extended to 450 days if the driver living abroad has committed an offence in a rental car, in which case the notification must be sent to the car rental company within 90 days, following which the rental company has 360 days to send the penalty notice to the offender. In my experience of picking up the odd fine abroad in car rental cars, they will also send you a bill for grassing you up, which is the one that I love. It's like the letter is like, oh, I've got a speeding fine in X country. Oh, that's not the speeding fine. That's just the charge from the hire car company for grassing me up. I will be getting the speeding fine soon. Great. So Dean goes on. In your case, it sounds like the parking tickets have been sent out of time. If so, and you were driving your own vehicle, respond to the tickets, cite this fact, invite them to withdraw the charges. Make them an offer they can't refuse. However, if you were driving a rental car at the time, my advice is to pay the tickets despite the time issue. I say this because in Italy, when you receive a fine while driving a rental car, the fine is notified to all rental companies until it is paid, meaning it is difficult to hire a car again if you have an unpaid fine against your name. So another reason not to ignore fines from overseas is that authorities may use debt collection agencies to recover fines. So that is the answer. And as I said, in my experience, you are unlikely but not totally safe from getting a fine if you do it in your own car. In your own car, they can come after you from Europe for, you know, speeding fines from like a speed camera, for example, or parking tickets, but they are very unlikely to come after you. If you are in a rental car, then they will go to the rental car company and the rental car company will give them your details and charge you for grassing you up. Oh, it's normally like about 20 or 30 quid. It's probably gone up because the rental car companies are trying to make as much money as they possibly can. And I have a story about this actually once. We were in a small French town and we parked and it was free parking. You could park So for up to an hour. So we parked, we went off and got, like, you know, some lunch or a drink or whatever. Came back, got a parking ticket. I was like, oh, that's really unfair. And I realized it was because you had to put one of those little clock things in your car. So this is the thing to look out for. When you get your rental car, do you have one of those little clock things? Because in a lot of places in Europe, they use that. You put it in the window and it shows what time you arrived. And so they know whether you've parked for an hour or not. And if you don't have a little clock thing, you can go to the tourist office or something, you can get one. But if you don't put one in, even if you've been less than an hour, you might get a ticket. Now, we were right by the police station. So I thought, well, that's fine. I'll go into the police station and I'll say to them, look, I've got this ticket. You know, what can I do? Because it said it was issued by the police municipal. So I went in, I said to the guy, I said, I've got this. And he said, well, did you have a little clock thing? I said, no, I didn't have a little clock thing. He said, well, you know, you have to have a little clock thing. I said, but I'm British. I don't have a little clock thing. And he said, well, you need a little clock thing, otherwise you'll get a ticket. And I was like, right. I was like, but, you know, I think I can prove that I was there for less than an hour. Is there anything you can do about it? He said, there's nothing I can do about it. You've been issued the ticket. You need the little clock thing. I was like, oh, right. I said, this seems really unfair. And then he looked at me and he said, you're British, right? And I was like, yeah. And he's like, so why are you worrying? You can just ignore the ticket. And I was like, oh, great. And he was like, yeah, have a good day. I was like, have a good day. And off I went. And my other driving tip for France is on the motorway, you will see speed camera signs. They warn you about speed camera. That tells you that there is a speed camera coming up. Once you are past that speed camera, you should be okay because they have to tell you about every speed camera. But what you have to be really careful about is they don't paint the speed cameras bright yellow like they do in this country, and they're much harder to spot. So you see that speed camera sign, slow down. Don't break the speed limit. Just don't break the speed limit at all, obviously.
Well,
but if you do see the sign, be careful. There will be a speed camera coming up. Little grey box. Watch out for them. They're quite difficult to spot.
Right, Simon, thank you very much. Your stat of the week.
Okay, my stat of the week is that figures yesterday showed a record 1 in 10 women aged 65 and over are now in work. Total number of women aged 65 and over who are working now stands at 686,000 after an increase of 135,000 over the past 12 months. That surge accounted for nearly a quarter of the total 608,000 rise in employment over that period. And our Steve Webb, said that the issue of those who cannot afford to retire was becoming increasingly pressing. This is being credited to a number of things. Obviously, the state pension age went up for women, went up for everyone, but it went up for women more substantially than others. Some have complained that they were not properly warned about this. Women's pension savings often fall short from times when either they were out of work looking after children, looking after others, and didn't manage to get the, they didn't manage to build up their pension pots in the same way. And also women's pension savings do also tend to fall short. Hopefully this is something that will have been remedied somewhat by auto-enrollment, but for a generation of women, it is an issue. And whilst there are many women who are choosing to work longer, my mum is now 76 and still runs her own business. There are many women for whom it is unfortunately not a choice. So there's my stat of the week.
That is a good stat. Simon, thank you very much. Thank you very much to Lee, and thank you for listening. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or you can download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon,
you can email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk and you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast, find all podcast past and join in the debate and read the comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.